Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting story ahead of us, you know, quite inspiring. We're going to be talking about changes in leadership, how to deal with them. You know, we're going to be talking about too the period of going through, you know, the first customer, the first shipment, also raising, you know, Series A's. And, you know, in this case, you know, our founder has raised closed with his team, you know, to $80 million, which is incredible. But they also dealt with some ups and downs, especially with what happened with Silicon Valley, you know. And then also going through regulatory compliance, which is not easy because as a startup, as you know, you're already dealing with the uncertainty of building a business. So also dealing with the regulatory compliance is double the trouble. So again, today, the conversation quite inspiring, building, scaling, financing, all of that good stuff that we like to hear. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Steve Tuck. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. Excited to be here. I have enjoyed listening to the podcast over the last couple of weeks.
So born in California, Steve, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Piedmont, little East Bay community, and had grown up in a household where my folks had a small heating and air conditioning company. So that was sort of the center of our universe growing up. And summer jobs were spent lining plenums and bending metal and running service deliveries out to technicians that were doing furnace installs, air conditioning installs. And then had the very good fortune of being able to go to college and went to University of Wisconsin, spent 4 years there, and then moved down to Austin, Texas, where I started at Dell Computer.
Now, how was it like, you know, being at Dell Computer? Because, I mean, you got the chance there, too, of being at a company like that for, you know, 9 years. And I'm sure that during those years too, I mean, there was like some really interesting growth too. So how was the experience of being at Dell for you?
It was great. It was kind of wild getting there because I arrived in October 1999 and didn't have the fullness of appreciation for just how high-flying Dell had been in the previous decade, in the 90s. I think it was the highest growing stock on every exchange over the course of the decade. So I arrived in kind of the fervor that was Dell at the top of the personal computer industry. And it was a bit surreal because, you know, they had this incoming party for our class where they rained fake stock options down from the ceiling, and they played a song, "We Are Dellionaires," showing a bunch of employees dancing on tables, which was interesting. So it was kind of a bit of a surreal introduction into the technology sector at the time. But over the next couple of years, some pretty hard times, because this is right when the bubble burst. And you had a whole clear out of swaths of folks that were sort of at the top and then very quickly found themselves at the bottom. And then some also really interesting technological transformations as you had the advent of companies like VMware, where for the very first time, the industry was moving from single application, single server to putting 10 applications on the server, 100 applications on the server, which just was not something one did previously, and had the good fortune of kind of going through that transition state at Dell and a lot of transitions across industry. The thing that I really left there with the deepest appreciation for was just the manufacturing and operational and financial innovation that Dell sometimes is not as well known for. You know, direct from Dell was a slogan that was well known. But it was really, really fascinating kind of going into the factories and seeing just how much thought and innovation went into the cash conversion cycle and the efficiency that Michael built around that operation.
Now, one thing that is really amazing, you know, that I've been getting as part of your career and something that you really don't see often is loyalty. And in your case, I mean, before being an entrepreneur, I mean, you've been with two companies. I mean, one was Dell, the other one was Joyent, and almost for like really like a decade on each one of them. So What, for example, you know, like pushed you to go to Joy Int, and what got you into those companies for so long? What was that future that you were living into?
Yeah, I appreciate you noting that and noting that with positivity, because you amazingly these days, staying with a company for a long period of time is not looked upon the way that it was, I think, in the last couple of decades. But, you know, there was a period of time at Dell, I think I was 23, 24 years old. I was in a big all hands, and I was, you know, looking across a sea of people at the stage where a couple of Dell executives were up there giving a talk. And I just remember being so enamored with the culture and the product and the team. And I knew I was going to be at Dell the rest of my career. My goal was, I want to be on that stage in, you know, 20 years, not I want to be moving on to different companies and doing different things. And but as I got kind of deeper into my career at Dell, a couple of things happened. One was there was a new sector that was emerging, this what, you know, at the time was kind of called the Web 2.0 sector, where these little technology companies, Yahoo and Facebook and MySpace and others, were growing very, very rapidly, and were demanding things of their technology providers that were maybe a little off the beaten path. I mean, Dell and HP and IBM and others were building these kinds of Swiss Army knife systems that were good for any sector, any user, which delivers operational efficiency and kind of product focus. But for these kind of what would be the early hyperscalers, it was a bit of ill fit. And I was working with some of these companies, and they had been pushing for Dell to go in a little bit different direction to better cater to their needs. And there was some resistance around that and some trepidation around catering to these markets. And I think, you know, right in the same period where there was resistance to kind of moving and shifting a bit towards this market, one of the providers in this market, I had worked with them on a project and with Facebook, where they were opening up their API for the first time. Facebook had done all their development internally, and Mark really wanted to open up the API so third-party developers could create content on Facebook. Pretty controversial decision at the time. He pushed through. They had this big developer platform launch, and it was going to be Sun Microsystems, Facebook, and this company Joy Int, this little cloud computing company. And at the last minute, Sun was not able to ship in time. So I got a phone call at Dell, and they said, hey, would you like Dell? You know, Dell has a very small window to slot in here and be the technology partner for this important Facebook developer launch. Long story short, we were able to get Kit in their hands, get approval, and Dell kind of swapped in for Sun in this pretty big launch that sort of opened up the Facebook platform publicly. And in the midst of that, I ended up working very closely with the founders at Joy Int and began to get introduced to this new abstraction, cloud computing, that they had, you know, long believed and had kind of imbued in me that was going to be the future of computing. And those kind of combined forces was enough to dislodge me from Dell. And they had asked me to come over to Joy Int and head up the go-to-market efforts there in 2009. And that began, the next decade that would certainly have plenty of highs, plenty of lows. But again, found myself at a company that I thought I would be at for a very, very long time.
So Joy Int, for example, I mean, I know that there, you know, you were also, as we were mentioning, you know, for a decade, and there was like quite a bit of a turnover when it came to leadership. So what did you learn about, you know, perhaps culture and leadership that perhaps, you know, you knew you were going to apply later on?
Yeah, I think the couple of things that I got to live through at Joy in those first couple of years, the company fell into a trap that I think many, many startups fall into. And that is raised a bunch of capital and with kind of the aid of investors, were looking for growth and were trying to grow quickly enough to deliver on the promise that had been made around raising that capital. And the biggest challenge that the company hit was that growth, that push into go-to-market, was pre-product market fit. And it didn't matter whether there was product market fit, let alone what you're really looking for is sales market fit. It began to scale the company in all markets internationally and build out these vast go-to-market engines in the hope of generating that demand. And that can be very expensive. That it was a very, very, very expensive lesson for the company, and required the company to then go retrench a couple of years later and recapitalize going forward. And it certainly led to some turnover at the top of the company, and that happened, you know, more than once going through that period of having to kind of repair from one classic mistake, which is growth at any cost. And I think just as an industry, you saw that across the board when capital was cheap and a lot of money poured into this VC asset class in kind of the tail end of the last decade. And it was a hard lesson that we took into the formation of Oxide, which is making really, really sure that before you start scaling up go-to-market efforts, you've got a firm understanding of the product that you've built, the market you've built it for, the pain points that the product is solving for, and that you are trying to. There was a great quote from a partner at A16 who had said, you know, you want to make sure that before you are adding that next salesperson, you can see the whites of the customer's eyes. Like they're coming over the hill and they're just about to take you over. And that's when you hire that kind of next person. And, you know, I think we've been pretty mindful of investing ahead at Oxide where we need to, but certainly that's an important kind of gas pedal clutch balance that is critical to keep in check when building a company. And it was a tough lesson to join it.
Let's talk about Oxide. Obviously, you know, like you were now for like 20 plus, you know, years almost, you know, working for somebody else, you know, doing the 9 to 5, yeah, as we call it, you know, in the startup world. Now, what triggered, you know, for you to be okay with the idea of venturing into the unknown? Because I mean, that was a massive step, you know, after, you know, being for so long in corporate and working, you know, for another company. I mean, how was that, you know, for you, that transition?
Yeah, I mean, So a couple of things led to this. One was, again, bearing witness to some of the things that worked, some of the things that didn't work in prior companies, and really wishing that there was more change that we could have affected in those companies. And two was just recognizing a couple of market factors in our kind of tenure at Joyant. One was this rise of cloud computing. I mean, if you look at AWS pre-2010, it was less than a $1 billion business, right? Today, it's a $100 billion business. It's hard to find similar kinds of rises in industries anywhere over a decade plus period. So cloud computing really emerging, and we had, you know, a core belief that cloud computing was the future of computing. The company Joyant was acquired by Samsung. So in 2016, Samsung came through and bought Joyant. And the reason that they bought Joyant was another kind of light bulb that went off. Samsung in 2012 was selling devices against Apple. And where they were selling camera quality and processor power, Apple was selling, you know, we have your whole family and life wrapped up in a software platform. Much more compelling kind of product vision. And Samsung deeply realized they had to catch up on software. And to do that, they started using cloud computing. So 2012, they were a very small cloud computing customer. By 2015, they were a massive cloud computing customer, you know, on their way towards spending, you know, 8-9 figures in the public cloud. And they realized that for all the business innovation, they were catching up and developing software faster. They couldn't afford to stay. They were losing money for every mobile user they were signing up. And they recognized, like, we can't keep building on the public cloud only. We've got to keep this innovation, but move on-prem. Got to own this infrastructure. Samsung's one of the biggest technology owners in the world. they kind of canvassed the market and found that there was no technology solution to bring cloud computing on premises. So they bought a cloud computing company. And needless to say, there's not enough cloud computing companies for kind of the rest of these large enterprises that had, that were conflicted in that way. And that was definitely a bit of a light bulb. And then I think the last one was when we were at Joyent, we were building this large global cloud computing business, and we were running into a lot of issues where our software met the hardware. Where our control plane, kind of the sophisticated software layer that helps deal with multi-tenancy and elastic infrastructure services, where that ran on commodity hardware, Dell, Supermicro, Arista, these systems that, you know, had largely looked and stayed the same for the previous decade and a half, that's where all the issues were emerging in our large cloud stack. And we were talking to Amazon, Google, Facebook, the folks over there, asking them how they were dealing with these same issues. And that's, you know, when the big reveal happened, that they had been designing and building kind of modern cloud purpose-built infrastructure for almost a decade. And that this was sort of off limits to those that were building themselves on-prem.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then obviously, you know, you guys end up getting going with Oxide. So I guess for the people that are listening to really get it, what ended up being the business model of Oxide? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so, you know, our core kind of premise at Oxide is number one, again, that the future of computing is cloud computing. And cloud computing is not this notion of renting space at Amazon or, you know, Google or Microsoft. It's actually an architecture. It is a programmable interface to elastic infrastructure services that make it super easy for developers to deploy software and operate software. And if you also believe that cloud computing is important and will be ubiquitous, then it's a pretty logical next step that primitive can't only live in a rental-only model with these service providers. It would be like for accommodations, the hotel model being the only way you can live. There's no houses, there's no apartments, it's only hotels. And so our core belief was that you needed to have a computer that ran your cloud that you could own. And it turns out the on-premises market is, you know, a very, very, very large multi-hundred billion dollar market that is largely underserved. And the third piece was, if you're going to build a cloud computer, you've got to do hardware and software design together. And this is probably the most important kind of bit, the core belief of ours, you know, like NVIDIA and Apple and Tesla and others, that these kind of like outsized benefits to customers come about when companies take on both hardware and software, which was extremely controversial in the computing industry, right? And was one of the biggest questions we were raising our seed was like, what do you mean you're building hardware? I thought, isn't everything just a software problem? Are there even computers anymore? And so, to your question, we set out to build a computer that is much more in line with what you would find in the cloud hyperscalers that drive all of their benefits and innovation. But now it's for the first time open to the commercial market. So if you're a Fortune 1000 company that spends $500 million, $1 billion in IT infrastructure on premises every year, along with your public cloud spend, you now can get the same benefits of cloud computing, but in that on-prem owned model. And so we sell hardware and software together in an appliance-like solution that companies buy, deploy, and run.
That's amazing. And I know that you guys have raised close to $80 million. But I know that right after the Series A, there was a nerve-wracking moment that involved all of a sudden, all the money to evaporate. How was that? Because I know that it was a really tough time, where you guys were at the same moment, literally in parallel, dealing with regulatory, compliance and hurdles. So I'm sure that dealing with those two things at the same time, it was probably a nightmare. But what happened there and how did you get through it?
Yeah, so we were in the process of raising our Series A, and then had a whole lot going on as we were finalizing the product and getting the product ready to market. Because the system is, I say hardware and software, it is a de novo server design that's kind of built for cloud computing. We did our own switch, which in and of itself was a bit controversial early on, as we were talking to investors, and then we were assured by those that had been, say, at AWS early, that you had to build the switch into the computer if you wanted to really build for true cloud computing. Did our own operating system, firmware, control plane. There were a lot of pieces that were coming together as we were getting close to ship. And so we had raised the first tranche of our Series A. And you mentioned compliance. It turns out when you're shipping equipment like this into the enterprise, you have to pass FCC compliance. There's these emission standards that you have to meet so that you don't have people shipping electronic equipment at data centers that are, sending radio signals everywhere. We talked kind of extensively about that in our Oxide and Friends podcast, just talking about these things people don't typically go to depth on, PCBA bring up and compliance. So we get through compliance, huge hurdle. So now we're ready to ship. And then March hits and the funds that we had just raised are effectively unavailable because we had everything with SVB. And I know that in the startup community, this is an all too common story because most people banked with SVB, but it was a pretty dark period because all the energy that had gone into getting that raise done and then having no idea what was going to happen over the next couple of weeks. So the first focus was payroll for everybody. How do you make sure your employees get paid? We were very fortunate that we had our core investors that had offered to wire money if need be to cover payroll. But the other side of it is, what does the 6-month outlook look like? 12-month outlook look like? Because if you wanted to get the comp and look back at what happened to Washington Mutual in 2008, the distributions of cash from that were still happening in 2022. So that means that firms that had their money with SVB, like the worst case scenarios where you were going to get 60 cents on the dollar and you were going to get that over the course of many, many years. And, the thing that was probably most difficult for us was our employees, right? Because this is all in the news. So their families are asking them, do you still have a job? Are you getting paid? What's going to happen to Oxide? And things were, during that week, from that Wednesday when the first smoke started to kind of show up to when the Fed took over the bank on Friday morning, you heard all kinds of different stories flying around. The thing that we, again, God bless our investors that had let us know they were behind us, they were going to make sure we could continue the business, that the employees were going to get paid, was just being as transparent as we could with the employees, letting them know all the information we had as we had it, even as harrowing as it may be. I think it's more paralyzing for folks to be kind of theorizing about what might happen than even knowing explicitly what is occurring and sometimes how little you know about the situation. But yeah, that was an unexpected one. I think, you know, COVID hitting within 3 months of raising our Series Seed, and then SVB collapse within a couple of months of our A. We're definitely, you know, we knew some of the headwinds and the risks in a startup, and a startup like this. Those two were not planned.
The excitement and the adrenaline never stops, eh, Steve? Now, I have a question for you, because obviously, as we're talking about money and we're talking about investors, you know, it's always betting on a vision. So as we're thinking about the vision of Oxide, if you were to go to sleep tonight and you woke up in a world where the vision of Oxide was fully realized, what would that world look like?
I think you would see a world in which the on-premises IT market, which, you know, by some measures is on the order of $150 to $250 billion. That market today is still made up of a kit car of four or five different IT vendors kind of smashed together in these racks that is running about as inefficiently as you could imagine. The average rack in the data center today, 25% of the energy of that rack goes just to moving fans, which is wild. The average utilization of the resources available in these racks is 25%. In AWS, that utilization is 70, 80%. AWS would be out of business if they ran anywhere close to the way the infrastructure the kinds of technologies and infrastructure that's available to folks that are running on-prem today. You've got very little automation. You do not have the same kind of elasticity of services that make it easy for multi-tenancy and for developers to be productive. So I think that a future that is necessary is expanding and extending all the innovations that have gone into cloud hyperscaler infrastructure over the last 15 years, and converting that on-prem market to being vastly more efficient, vastly higher utilization, and fully API driven and programmable. So you get to take these brilliant folks that these enterprises and everyone has that are excellent engineers that are working on things like BIOS update and license management and server racking and stacking, and letting them free up their talents to go work on the things that each individual business is building and known for, what their customers are looking for. And if that happens, you're going to see just GDP growth, you're going to see productivity in the markets that we just haven't had before. And then we're also going to see the ability to take on new technologies in support of things like AI, because we are much more energy efficient in the way that we're running infrastructure on premises. And to do that, you've got to change the definition of what the computer is. It no longer can be this little pizza box that is totally disassociated from networking and storage and software. And you need to have a really well designed together integrated system that is software driven.
So we're talking about the future. I want to talk about the past. October 2019. Okay, I'm bringing you back in time. You have that younger Steve right in front of you. What would you tell that younger Steve before launching the business, and why?
Oh, man. Well, bank with more than one bank. No, I'm just kidding.
One piece of advice. What would you tell that younger Steve?
I think what I would tell myself is that no matter how difficult or seemingly impossible things are at any one particular moment, you're going to clear that next hurdle. The company is going to clear that next hurdle. And really just maintaining optimism throughout. I think the optimism and transparency have been the two most important values of the values that we, I mean, I look, I could pick any one of them, but, you know, leaning into transparency and then making sure to maintain optimism. I didn't have to tell myself this at the time, but if it were, you know, 6 months earlier, it would have been make sure that you, or I would put it differently. The most important thing we did was making sure that we, when Brian and I founded the company together, it was choosing a partner that had the same goals, the same values, the same principles, and really the same kind of long-term view. I mean, you asked a question earlier about being at two companies over 20 years. You know, we founded this company not to build a computer company. We founded this company to build the kind of company that employees could be proud of saying they work for in 20 years. And that we would be able to recapture that same moment in time where I was at Dell and looking at the stage, and Brian was at Sun Microsystems and looking at the stage, and create a culture and a team and a mission that folks would be incredibly proud to be a part of. And I think, you know, just making sure to stay on that original vision and set of goals, despite venture capital and despite all the different things that are going to pull you in different directions, that has been the most important part of the journey so far.
That's amazing. Well, hey, Steve, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, you can reach me on Twitter. My DMs are open at SDTuck. Not to promote a podcast on a podcast, but we have shared a lot about Oxide on our Oxide and Friends series, and kind of runs the gamut. But if you're interested in the hardware software interface, that one is has got a lot of the war stories and scars from, you know, PCB bring up to compliance and all the things, the ups and downs along the journey. I think those are probably the two best vectors.
Amazing. Well, hey, Steve, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show. It has been an honor to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.